Givern, as something was happening. And they gave us the number in a phone booth. The guy who had a walkie.
Senate Judiciary Committee, Wednesday, January 23rd, 1991.
Someone's having a baby?
Yeah, my wife.
To come to order. Apologize for being late. We had a matter that came before the caucus a few minutes ago. And we'll start down the agenda as published, and start with Senate Bill 421, Paul Gary Conkling and Company. The folks who've been working on this bill during the interim, with the interim committee and various interested parties. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Conkling, and I, along with Henry Hewitt, who has joined me here at the desk, are representing a group of Oregon-based corporations interested in Senate Bill 421. We have two of the representatives for those companies that are en route, one from Portland and one from Eugene, and as you can see at the moment, they're not yet here, but I think momentarily will arrive. What we would propose today as a panel is to try to provide some background on this bill. And Mr. Hewitt of Sol, Rees, Boley, Jones, and Gray will do that. And joining us...
Let me just interrupt you to say that if don't be too panicked, because if you will let you proceed with your part of it, and then we'll take a break and move on and bring the rest of the folks when they
arrive. Fair enough. Well, they probably will arrive as we're going forward. Right. So with that, I'll stop and let Henry move forward.
Senator Cohen, members of the committee, I'm Henry Hewitt, a partner in the law firm of Stoll, Rees, Boley, Jones, and Gray in Portland, and I'm here today on behalf of Tektronix, Precision Cast Parts, Bohemia, and Electroscientific Industries in support of Senate Bill 421, which would strengthen Oregon's existing laws regulating takeovers. The bill is also supported by other publicly held corporations in Oregon, including Mentor Graphics, Floating Point Systems, Willamette Industries, and Northwest Natural Gas. The bill would add a Business Combination Act to Oregon's existing statutes regulating takeovers. This act is modeled after a statute enacted several years ago in Delaware. By way of background, in 1987, the Oregon legislature adopted the Oregon Control Share Act. The purpose of that statute is to protect shareholders in the event of a takeover attempt and to provide an incentive for an acquirer to negotiate with the board of directors before a change of control occurs. Although the act is complex, it limits the voting rights of a shareholder who acquires more than 20% interest in a publicly held Oregon corporation unless the other shareholders approve the right to vote in a separate shareholder action. That statute was modeled after the Indiana statute and has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1987, Oregon was one of the first states to adopt the statute after it was approved by the Supreme Court. The Control Share Act was amended in 1989 to delete a sunset provision and to make other minor changes. Since the enactment of the Oregon Control Share Statute, a number of states, most notably Delaware, have adopted a different type of statute regulating takeovers known as business combination statutes. Business combination statutes are intended to cause bidders to negotiate with the target company, particularly when they anticipate the desirability of a post-acquisition restructuring of the target. Under the Delaware Business Combination Statute and the proposed combination, Oregon Business Combination Act, a person who acquires a 15% interest in a target company is prohibited from effecting a post-merger or other business combination with the target, a so-called self-dealing transaction, or from selling significant assets during the following 3 years. There are a number of exceptions to the operation of the statute. For example, the second step or post-acquisition transaction can occur if the acquisition is approved by the target's board of directors before the 15% threshold is reached. It also can occur if two-thirds of the shareholders of the target approve the transaction. It also can occur if the acquirer acquires at least 85% of the shares of the target company. Most states that have adopted business combination statutes have included more stringent requirements and fewer exceptions than those proposed in the Oregon legislation and contained in the Delaware statute. The proposed Oregon statute is modeled after the Delaware statute rather than the more stringent approaches. The Delaware business combination statute has been challenged in a number of cases on constitutional grounds and uniformly upheld, although not been considered by the United States Supreme Court. I think it's the view of most that the issues are the same as those considered by the court when it approved the approach of the Indiana statute. At least 23 states now have business combination statutes patterned after Delaware and similar to the one proposed in Senate Bill 421. Recent trend has been for states to adopt both a business combination statute and a controlled share statute, and at the present time, at least 14 states have both. The Oregon corporations we are representing believe that it would be desirable for Oregon to add a Business Combination Act to Oregon's existing Control Share Act. The Control Share Act and the Business Combination Act are designed to deal with two different aspects of takeovers. The purpose of the existing Control Share Statute is to provide shareholders with the opportunity to vote on whether or not there will be a change of control. The proposed Business Combination Act addresses conduct by a bidder following a successful tender offer. The act is intended to reduce the risk of takeover bids in which the bidder intends a self-dealing transaction following the acquisition that may be likely to have an adverse impact on the target company, its employees, or the communities in which the target conducts its business. The Business Combination Act would prohibit the bidder from making a tender offer, would not prohibit a bidder from making a tender offer, acquiring shares, voting the shares, electing the board of directors, or entering into transactions with unrelated third parties, or otherwise carrying on the business of the target corporation. It would provide additional protection and increased leverage for negotiations in connection with certain potentially abusive or undesirable takeover bids. It's not intended to and will not prevent hostile takeovers of Oregon corporations. Its purpose is to encourage a bidder to negotiate the terms of the proposed acquisition with the target company's board of directors and to protect Oregon corporations, shareholders, employees, and communities against the often devastating effects of certain takeover bids. That's my prepared testimony, and I'd be happy to address any specific questions or other questions that any member of the committee might have.
Other questions? I guess I would be interested in saying there are. Would you go a little bit through the specific requirements, the type of things that this would require them to negotiate about, and what?
First of all, Senator Cohen, I think it's important to point out that it would only affect the ability of a bidder to do certain transactions after an acquisition that were with itself, so that if a bidder or a person seeking to do an acquisition wants to then merge it into the parent or sell its assets and use the proceeds to pay off parent company debt or other transactions that were for the benefit of the acquirer and may not be to the benefit ongoing of the target company, then the statute would apply. And those kinds of transactions would be prohibited for 3 years unless they're approved by the ongoing shareholders, approved by the target company in advance of the acquisition, or the acquirer acquires at least 85% of the shares.
So we're going to make them acquire 85% or negotiate an agreement with if they're going to do anything that has to do with selling, consuming.
Right. Mortgaging.
Mortgaging, moving out of. What about moving out of state?
They could do that.
They could move. They could move them out.
This really doesn't prevent any kind of thing that they might do with a third party or independent of a transaction in which the acquirer would benefit. So that yes, they would be free to conduct their business as they thought it was best conducted, within the limits that they couldn't benefit differently from other shareholders.
The purchasing part, the takeover entity couldn't benefit unduly. Who makes those decisions? Ultimately, it goes into court based on stockholders alleging that you're crossed the line of the law, right? I mean, who's the referee in all of this technical side that decides whose interest is it really is benefiting from some particular action?
Well, it's ultimately the courts, but I think it's important to note both with respect to the proposed legislation in Section 421 and other similar legislation that it brings about negotiation and resolution more often than not between companies seeking to acquire other companies and the targets. And the sorts of things that get negotiated are generally issues that are of interest to states such as Oregon. It may be a better price for the shareholders. It may be agreements with respect to continuing operations in the state that exist in the state at the time of the acquisition. It may be better provisions for employees who may be laid off as a result of the consolidation that might occur. But this kind of statute, along with other things like it, provide leverage that wouldn't otherwise exist for companies to have a basis for negotiating those kinds of issues. Ultimately, if you're asking me what happens if a shareholder is saying the company is being unreasonable and not accepting this proposal, today there's a wide body of law relating to acquisitions all over the country with respect to the obligation and duty of the board to look out for those constituencies, and if they aren't properly looking out for the constituencies that the statute provides, courts will dictate that they act otherwise. And frankly, I think that the approach in Delaware that's being proposed in Oregon is felt to be a balanced approach that would not prevent acquisitions from occurring, but create a basis for a negotiation, and more likely that acquisitions that do occur will be in the best interest of those kinds of constituencies, the shareholders, the employees, and the communities in which these companies do business. At Bill Taylor's suggestion, we are going to prepare what I would call, I guess it's a summary that really does try to cut through the rather technical provisions of this bill for you to have available to you that, frankly, I think in a less complex way, and I think this can be made less complex way, will outline precisely when it operates, what it affects, and when it doesn't operate, because many, many acquisitions occur. In fact, most acquisitions would occur in circumstances that would not be affected by this statute. Those are, frankly, the ones that are negotiated and agreed to. And that's more common than not.
It's basically something that's not agreed to along the way. Senator Hill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are the statutes that are more stringent, what kind of features have those had?
Those would have the kind of thing that they would apply regardless of whether or not there was a shareholder vote or a higher shareholder vote. It might require an 80% shareholder vote before this statute wouldn't apply. They would, the one that I guess is maybe of a different sort entirely that's gotten a lot of press recently in Pennsylvania would combine this with the requirement that any profit that a bidder made on an acquisition that wasn't successful would be disgorged to the corporation. Those have become very controversial and I think are designed to prevent bidders and to prevent acquisitions, whereas I think the Delaware approach and this approach is designed to assure that parties are encouraged to negotiate and resolve issues looking out for the company, its shareholders, employees, and the communities.
Thank you.
If I might add, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the Delaware model came after a considerable amount of negotiations from a variety of parties and attempting to balance interests as well as also be mindful of the Commerce Clause, which is essentially the constitutional test against which these types of measures are evaluated. And I think one of the key tests, as I read commentators on this law, is whether or not the Williams Act, which governs tender offers, is frustrated by a state statute, or whether or not it's impossible to comply with both the state statute and the Williams Act. And I think that the courts have held that both in the case of control share statutes as well as business combination statutes with these features, the Williams Act is neither frustrated nor is someone left unable to comply with both these kinds of state statutes and the Williams Act.
Any other questions? Okay.
Our other people have not joined us, and I did get a message, Madam Chair, while I was sitting here, that Mr. Reagan has been sidelined for a while with a matter that he was in hearing in Eugene and won't be here until a bit later this afternoon. So maybe we can stand down, and when one or the other arrives, I'll let you know, and whenever it's appropriate, if they could testify, they'd appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In addition to Mr. Reagan, and Alan Leedy, who are not being able to come, is there anyone else in the audience who has not had a chance to sign up who would like to come forward and testify on Senate Bill 421 at the moment? Thank you.
Madam Chair, before you...
Senator Hill.
Thank you. Before you leave, I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but... I'm an employee of Mentor Graphics Corporation, so let that be noted if there is a conflict of interest there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Actually, the most appropriate time is on the floor, but and I think it's useful to do it right here, too, in case you need to do that. Okay. Next item on the agenda deals with... that we'll take up would be Senate Bill 427. Are there folks here? Jim Spickerman is here, and Bob Olson. Jim, is that how you say your name again?
Spickerman.
Spickerman. That was close.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you, and I'll be fairly brief. I am Vice President of the Oregon State Bar and Chair of the Public Affairs Committee of the Board of Governors, and the Public Affairs Committee deals with legislative matters. Our job is to monitor and coordinate the bar's legislative program. I would like to, there are members of the staff that are here, and I won't go through and introduce them. I would like to introduce one individual, however, who is on my committee, who is the newest member of the Board of Governors, recently appointed. He's a public member, Charles Davis, who is already here checking on the lawyers to see that we're doing a good job. Mr. Davis, I think some of you probably know Mr. Davis.
We're glad he's still watching.
Yes. I've also brought with me my lawyer this afternoon, General Counsel for the Oregon State Bar, Mr. Reamer, who has prepared an outline which I think you have received, which explains the bar's proposed Senate Bill 427. First, just a brief remark or two about how we get bar legislation. I think most of you know that we have section bills which are prepared and carried by the sections involving law improvement matters in particular areas of law that section deals with, and they will be doing the lobbying for themselves in that area. We will coordinate and advise them, but we generally don't do any lobbying. On state bar matters, which we consider to be public policy issues, then the bar itself will be lobbying those issues. Few brief comments that I'll make about Senate Bill 427, which is intended to be our vehicle for all proposed changes in the Bar Act. You have the handout, and I'm sure you haven't had a chance to read it because it was just given to you, but so I'll go through the section by section just briefly and then try to answer any questions that any of you have. about any of those sections, and if I can't, I'll turn it over to my counsel, George Reamer, who will answer them. Section one is a housekeeping matter. Traditionally, for as many years as I can remember, the officers of the bar have been elected in a process whereby the president, who is elected by the members of the Board of Governors, is elected in June, and then in the next meeting, which would be August, the rest of the officers are elected, but they do not take office until after the annual meeting when the outgoing officers go out. Somebody made the mistake of looking at the statute last year and found out that it requires that as soon as an officer is elected, they are supposed to take office. And what we're simply asking that it be changed so that it follows the procedure that we've always followed, and they can be elected in June, but not take president-elect, but not take office until September. Section 2 deals with the information that's provided to the Chief Justice. Presently, a financial statement is provided annually and required to be provided to the Chief Justice by the bar, and it's a statement showing essentially the receipts and expenditures, and it's really not all that helpful, and we're asking that as a substitute for that, the Executive Secretary be required to provide to the Chief Justice a statement of financial condition each year for the past year, which we think will be more helpful to the Chief Justice and more helpful to the bar, because it will, we will have to prepare that. Section 3 and 4, again, is a pretty much a housekeeping matter. We're asking to add to the requirements of someone who is going to apply and become a member of the, be admitted to the bar, that they, in addition to the other requirements, they be fit to practice law. And all this does is make the statute and the Bar Act the same as the current bar rules, which were approved by the Board of Governors and have been adopted by the Supreme Court, so that we have the same rules for under the bar rules of procedure and under this act. Section 5, again, is an effort to have the disciplinary rules of the Oregon State Bar and the Bar Act coincide. The disciplinary rules, this has to do with lawyer maintaining client confidences. The disciplinary rules already require that, but the disciplinary rule has some exceptions, which we think are essential, and I think the committee would agree that if the client is about to commit a crime, under the disciplinary rules, a lawyer can breach the confidence if the client consents to it. If the court orders the confidence to be disclosed, then the secret to be disclosed is. If the lawyer has to disclose the client confidence in order to defend himself against an action, him or herself against an action by a client, that would be an exception. So we're asking that the Bar Act simply, it's not necessary because we already have the procedural rules with these exceptions, so we're asking that that be deleted.
Madam Chair?
Are you also asking that rather than have any statutory requirement for attorney-client confidentiality, that we rely upon the rulemaking authority of the bar for that, as the bar may from time to time decide is appropriate? Is that the thrust of this section?
I suppose yes, except that I don't anticipate that it's going to change from time to time. This has been traditionally a part of the disciplinary rules for a long time, which of course has to be approved by the Supreme Court.
But if we go for this, we will be allowing a group other than the lawmakers to decide upon that question for the entire state and the relationships of attorneys and clients.
I just want to be sure I'm clear on the significance of the change, because it seems to me it is a significant change.
I think that's correct. Would you agree with that?
I might address that if I...
Sure.
Why don't you come on up, George?
I'm George Reamer, counsel with the Oregon State Bar. This particular statute, 9.460, is really a disciplinary statute. And the disciplinary rules are also in effect. And so what we want to do is just have one clear standard talking about a lawyer being disciplined for breaching a client confidence or secret. This doesn't affect the other statute, which establishes the attorney-client privilege. So to answer your question, this is not affecting that at all. This just deals with the disciplinary consequences of violating confidence.
Okay. Thank you. That makes a substantial difference.
And let me ask you to direct us, if you know offhand, where that privilege is really listed in your...
The privilege is not mentioned here because we're not affecting it, but I think
that,
it's
you know
ORS...
No, she's looking for the disciplinary rule.
No, I'm looking for the
attorney-client privilege statute.
Yes.
I think it's ORS chapter 40-something.
We'll find it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
I really
care about
that. Thank you.
Helps my comfort level.
Good. Okay, the next is section 6. And we're at the present time, the assessment for the client security fund is limited to a maximum of $25, which is what is presently authorized to be assessed. We're simply asking that the Board of Governors be allowed, if necessary, in order to keep the money in the fund to pay claims, that we be allowed to raise it to a figure higher than $25. This is an assessment for lawyers for the client security fund.
So you're really looking to move away from any kind of prescribed cap?
Yes. We would hope that we will not have to go above 25, but rather than having to come back and ask for a different cap, if it's necessary, we're asking that that be that authority be given to the board.
Madam Chair.
Yes, I'm sure.
It all, if I read it correctly, though, it also at least would permit the Board of Governors to reduce that assessment.
Oh yes.
In other words, it gives a discretion, total discretion, regarding the client security fund assessment to the Board of Governors as far.
That's
not an increase, but...
That's right. Which is the direction we would hope to go.
Does that mean that in the last 6 or 8 years you've established a better confidence level with your client attorney so that they're not in here and those on this committee are clamoring to have that cap there? I recall the days when people who really wanted the $25 cap...
Well, I remember when we originally developed the fund, and I remember there was very vocal opposition to any fund at all, and so I'm sure there were people who would have, if they agreed to that, would want a cap, and it was at $15 originally, and then it was raised to $25.
So there's enough confidence out there that, number one, it has to be, and number two, that they are getting enough benefit from it that you're not sensing in your membership any concern or...
Actually, as part of the membership dues, we have the Client Security Fund assessment in there. So really, yearly, the membership approves. The board has presented that to the membership for approval. So while I think technically the board might not have to do that, it has. And the membership has approved the $25. And really, the $25 has only been in effect, I think, for 2 years. Before that, I think it was 13, and then before that, it was even down to $3. Problem is, we've just had a fair number of recent claims, and the amount of money that that generated wasn't enough to make for a viable client security fund.
Any other questions?
Senator Hammy.
Madam Chair, may I ask the witness to go back to Section 5. In your printed testimony, you have, in your second paragraph there in your explanation, the Supreme Court suggested that the statute may impose a duty on lawyers beyond that which is imposed by the bar's disciplinary rules. Could you give me an explicit example?
Senator Hambly, when you read the statute, it just says that lawyers shall maintain inviolate the confidences and secrets of a client. The disciplinary rule already spells out, and as an attachment to the memo is the text. And the problem is the statute is very categorical, and it seems to suggest that there are no exceptions. The problem is our disciplinary rules provide for a number of exceptions, so that you could make an argument that the statute being in existence, even though you have the disciplinary rule, you don't get the benefit of the exceptions. And that just doesn't seem right, as you have two potentially inconsistent standards on the same issue or the same concept.
Madam Chair.
Sure.
Pursue this further, because I'm not sure I understand. The disciplinary rules now are both in statute and in rule.
Seems somewhat broad. When I see things like respect for the law, appreciation of the rights of others, and these kind of things, I don't know. It just seems very, it just seems very, very broad. And I guess I'm trying to look for some specific examples of what you're getting at here. And maybe if you have some cases, you know, your actual cases that you've had, to give some idea of what you're trying to get at, maybe I'd feel more comfortable. But anyway, I mean, because I figure if someone is convicted of any kind of a crime, then obviously that's something that you look at. But when I have some visions here of somebody who's involved in some kind of civil disobedience, or in some kind of a protest or something, I'm just a little unclear as to what the line is here. Anyway, that's.
I just would make one observation that it is up to the Supreme Court to decide ultimately to admit people. So the Board of Bar Examiners is making a recommendation. And, I mean, I think there are safeguards here. The bar has no political or ideological litmus test for applicants. And I want to make that clear, that we're talking about what we're looking for in good lawyers and competent and honest lawyers and the credentials that need to be presented to justify giving someone the license to practice law. And so that's the orientation here. And I can provide Mr. Taylor with some case law, just some recent examples of how this standard has been applied,
okay,
where actually people who have had some problems in the past have been admitted. Based on the Supreme Court's review of these types of situations.
Thank you.
The more you answered, the more concerned I was, actually, in dealing with these questions of the rights of others. You talked about the person who chose to break the law, whether it's a nuclear protester, an anti-abortion protester, civil rights protester. Don't you end up with a very dangerous subjective area where you may be in one case saying, well, they were standing up for somebody else's rights, so that's justified. Or in another case, if you disagree with their position, mightn't there be a tendency to say they were walking on someone else's rights because of that protest? You know, we all have causes we believe in, and it's hard, I think, to say that person who was standing up for my point of view was walking on somebody's rights. But it's very easy to say someone who was protesting the opposite view, well, they were walking on the other person's rights. Doesn't subjectivity become a difficult thing to deal with in that?
Yes, it does, as does the existing law that requires that they be of good moral character. We're talking about an area that I think is unfortunately subjective. And it you hopefully
with the checks and balances, and I think historically you will find that it has been the case that the subjective standards have not been abused, but they are necessary. You can't just say that we're going to give this person a license to go out and represent the public because they have enough money to pay the fees and they passed the exam. There is more to it. And it is, yes, Senator, it is subjective.
Okay, and I guess it was just a parallel question with the frivolous lawsuit. You know, what's frivolous to one person certainly isn't frivolous to another. And that's...
That certainly, you're right, that is a judgment. But there, I suppose you could always think of an example of someone who was filing on a regular basis lawsuits just strictly for harassment purposes, then while going to law school or go to law school, finish, pass the bar, and you say, now, that's not the kind of person that would be a reasonable member of the bar to represent the public in assessing whether claims are good or bad.
My question was answered, and that is, I just wanted to have on the record the process of appeal from that decision of the Board of Bar Examiners, that it is the Supreme Court of the state which ultimately may decide that application.
Correct.
And you have to put your trust somewhere.
Mr. Rima, what kind of criteria would you apply, or have you applied in the past, where you've had a situation where someone who's been charged with criminal trespass, say, over nuclear disarmament or some issue like that, that has political connotations?
What type of criteria?
Right, in judging that application.
The experience that I've had is more in the area where a lawyer, already a member of the bar, has been engaging in some act of illegal conduct. And we have a process that reports the conviction to the Supreme Court. We have a board that makes a recommendation whether the lawyer should be suspended. And we have really sanctioned criteria that are quite complicated, that take into consideration lots of things, like the person's past record, the seriousness of the violation, whether it be a felony or a misdemeanor, and a number of other factors in mitigation. You know, someone could have an explanation, whether or not it's a justification to engage in that misconduct or not. And then a record is developed, and it's ultimately up to the Supreme Court to decide whether the person should be sanctioned for that violation. So on the admission side, it's whether you get in. Once you're a member of the bar, then it's a question of whether you're going to be sanctioned for it. So I can provide you really with the sanction criteria that we have, and really it's the American Bar Association has a very elaborate set of commentary and rules in applying mitigating and aggravating factors to determine where what type of sanction should be imposed.
One further question, Madam Chair. Mr. Rima, to your knowledge, has anyone ever been sanctioned, that's a lawyer, or privileges denied someone, an applicant, solely based on the issue of criminal trespass where there was a civil disobedience issue involved?
I'd have to check. Not to my knowledge. I know that we had one lawyer who was convicted of trespass, I think, in Nevada for having gone to a nuclear protest. The lawyer reported that to the bar, and then we reported to the Supreme Court, and I think after a review of that, no sanction was imposed. But, you know, it's a question of lawyers take an oath to abide by the law, and they also have a duty under our rules to report their having engaged in been convicted of a crime. And then we have this review process that determines if there's if it's appropriate to impose a sanction for that violation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
As far as this appreciation of the rights of others, you mentioned frivolous lawsuits. Do you sanction lawyers who have been admitted for filing frivolous lawsuits?
We certainly receive complaints that lawyers have filed frivolous lawsuits, and I believe we have one case, and I'd have to probably try to come up with some concrete examples of reported cases. But I know that we have one case that is pending review by the Supreme Court right now that is based on allegations of a number of violations of those kind of rules.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about, you mentioned frivolous lawsuits.
Yeah, this case deals with that. That the lawyer was involved in, allegedly involved in filing a series of harassing and frivolous lawsuits, counterclaims, and that sort of thing.
And so it was, so that they could be sanctioned for that?
They could be sanctioned for that. I mean, the whole area of what is frivolous is quite complicated, and there's probably a very large body of case law, even in the civil area, as to when you can impose sanctions for engaging in frivolous litigation. And a lot of these areas just are quite complex.
And one final thing. Senator Shoemaker mentioned review by the Supreme Court. When someone has to go before the, when a case goes before the Supreme Court, do they have to hire counsel?
Normally, yes.
How long would that usually take? For these, for this to go through the process up to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think you're talking probably a year. I'd have to get some hard data on that, but, you know, to have the review by the Board of Bar Examiners, and then if they recommend against the person's admission, the court would refer it ordinarily to a disciplinary board. You'd have a hearing, a record, and it would go up to the court. Briefs would be filed, oral argument, and then the court's decision. So all of that process does take some time.
Okay, and Matthew, I'll just end with this. I guess it seems like we have kind of a catch-all here, and I mean, I know that having, when you're admitted and so forth, waiting a year and all these things and hiring a lawyer to get admitted to the bar is not an inconsequential thing to have to deal with, and I guess that's my concern. So we can get some information about what you're specifically talking about, it would be helpful.
Great. Any other comments before we end the...
Madam Chair, may I,
Senator Abney?
May I clarify? The witnesses will review the notion of incorporate, the possibility of incorporating 4101 into statutes.
Thank we'll you. See, work with staff and see what that looks like and whether they decide that they don't want to do it, and that, then it'll be up to the committee to take a look at it. But we'll check that out. Thank you very much. Anyone else who would like to comment on Senate Bill 427? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go then and return to Senate Bill 421, and Alan Leedy is here. And we do have Alan's testimony, folks. It's in your file on Senate Bill 421.
Tough call. The lawyer's as a
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Alan Leedy. I'm general counsel of Tektronix, and I appreciate this opportunity to appear in behalf of Senate Bill 421. You have my written testimony. I would like to emphasize three things. First of all, the state has a compelling interest in the subject matter of this legislation. The bill, as proposed, would not prevent takeovers, but it would diminish the likelihood that takeovers would take place without the involvement of the board of directors of the target company exercising its fiduciary role. And it would diminish the likelihood that takeovers would be financed through a breakup strategy in which assets of the target company would be sold off to finance the transaction and pay the transaction costs. Such transactions may from time to time appear attractive and in the short-term interests of shareholders, but they always carry very large transaction costs, legal fees, banking fees, and the like. And no continuing business is benefited by bearing the burden of such costs or by the coercive sale of assets. The second point I'd like to make is that Senate Bill 421 and the existing control share statute are complementary in the sense that they address different aspects of takeover transactions and would come into play at different times. And finally, I'd like to stress that this is not a dry theoretical or academic exercise that is being considered. While in the case of Tektronix, there is no imminent specific threat, the bill would fundamentally change the environment in which Tektronix and companies like it go about the task of restoring themselves to growth and profitability and preserving their value to the communities and the constituencies of which they are part. Those are the three points I wanted to emphasize, and I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Schumer.
Mr. Leedy, maybe you could enlarge on that last point, which you said the bill would change the present climate of the way that companies like Tektronix go about rebuilding their health.
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I believe that, as I mentioned, of course, Oregon has the control share statute currently in place, and that was a bill that was strongly supported as well by Tektronix. The significant thing from my perspective is that the existing law and the bill strengthen the hand of the board of directors in playing a role, playing and fulfilling their fiduciary role to get the best deal for the constituencies that they represent. The best deal may be no deal. It may be ongoing business, or it may be some takeover negotiated on terms that the board considers favorable. By having a situation in which the hostile acquirer can bypass the board and then look forward to financing the cost of the transaction out of a breakup of the company, I think that the playing field is not level.
Well, does Tektronix and other large Oregon companies conduct their present affairs in a way out of fear of a hostile takeover now, are you suggesting, and that this bill would change that climate so that that fear would be removed? Are you saying that the way you go about your business now is different?
The point I'd like to stress is not that, as you suggest, that strategies are set based on fear of hostile takeover. It is rather that should the situation actually arise in which a company, let's say like Tektronix, whose circumstances are improving, becomes a target, then at that point in time, this bill gives the board of directors a negotiating position that will help serve the interests that are important to the state.
Okay, so just what we're doing here is building a wall against problems that we anticipate based upon the experiences of other companies in other states.
That's
we haven't
correct.
Had that out here, and as far as I know, we're not conducting business out here on the assumption that we're going to have hostile takeovers. And
we know that we live in an environment in which takeovers are relatively common.
I don't know what you call that. Senator Buck.
Madam Chair, you talk about the hollowing out of a company. Are there examples of businesses in other parts of the country similar to Tech that this has happened to, and a wholesale layoff of the employees? Well, I guess what I'm getting at is it more common that there would be bits and pieces of the company sold, but the people would still be employed versus moving operations elsewhere and wholesale layoffs?
Madam Chair and Senator Bunn, I don't have detailed examples to offer. I would offer, though, the example that I think is known to most of us of the RCA Corporation and the loss of an important research activity, the loss of rather significant fundamental manufacturing activities in the area of semiconductor devices, And I think there are other examples in other industries that don't come to my mind just at the moment. But I think the risk of loss of jobs is real, and I think the risk of negative impacts on the economy as a whole are real.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the Business Combination Act, it's the testimony that we received says it addresses conduct by a bidder following a successful tender offer. So, in other words, there has been a successful tender offer, and does that mean that this is after the acquisition has been made? Need a
big one. Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the senator's supposition is correct. This bill would prevent certain transactions, business combination transactions, being carried out after a change in control of a company, unless certain things had happened in advance of the change of control, such as approval by the board of directors before the interested shareholder becomes an interested shareholder, or such as approval by a very substantial majority of shareholders.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thanks very much for your time, and thanks for making it down here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Anything else on 421 while we have the record open? Not hearing that. We'll move on then to Senate Bill 405. Wendell is here. Wendell Kuzneris. Rice.
Mr. Bronner indicated he would not object.
Okay. That's okay. Welcome.
Members of the committee, my name is Wendell Kuzneris. I'm an attorney. I'm employed by the Law Division of U.S. Bancorp, but I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's debtor-creditor section on this bill. What this bill does, and I believe I provided some a written summary for members of the committee, what this bill does is repeal subsection 3 of ORS 86095. ORS 86.095 currently provides that there are certain activities that the parties to a mortgage, the borrower and the mortgage lender, can do to change the terms of the mortgage. You can adjust the interest rate up or down. You can defer interest payments which are currently due and put them at the end, add them to principal and put them at the end of the term. You can execute new notes to replace the ones which were originally issued, extend the term, and so on. They're all spelled out in the act or in the statute. Subsection 3, which is the one in question here, provides that certain of those things, specifically a renegotiation of the interest rate, either up or down, the adding payments to the end of the mortgage, deferring current payments and adding them to the end, an execution of new notes will not affect the priority of the mortgage. This is important where there's a first lien on the property and a second lien. And the motivation of the bar was that if you have that situation, both a first lien and a second lien, and suppose the borrower gets into some financial trouble, is having difficulties making the payments. Well, the ordinary, usual first reaction is to go to the mortgage lender and try and negotiate a deal. And often that can be done. The mortgage lender often concludes they'd rather work with the borrower instead of having a foreclosure lawsuit, and that by making some concessions to the borrower of the type we're talking about here, changing interest rate, adding principal payments to the end or interest payments to the end, and so on, if you do these kinds of adjustments, the borrower will still be able to make the payments, and everybody will come out better off than if you did a foreclosure. The difficulty is that if you have cut such a deal between the lender and the borrower. Under current law, you may run smack into subsection 3 of ORS 86.095. That provides that these kinds of changes will not affect the priority of the first mortgage only if there's some specific magic language in the recorded document to that effect. If you got the magic language, you're okay. You can go ahead with your deal between the borrower and the lender, and we've avoided a lawsuit and a foreclosure. If you don't have the magic language,
The magic language is disclosure, right?
That's correct. It discloses that this kind of adjustment is permitted. If you don't have that in there...
Or that you've done it. Which way?
No, the language has to be in there at the inception when the mortgage is first signed and recorded. If it's not in there at that time, you can never add it later. And if you don't have it in there, disclosing that this is a possibility, you're not going to be able to cut your deal. The borrower loses and the lender loses because the lender is going
so
to have...
This is not a disclosure after the fact by saying that this is, in fact, what's happened, EEO consumer.
That's correct.
It has been extended, and there is X amount of penalties in terms of gratuities we're going to give you or collect from you for this privilege of extending it without... calling in your mortgage.
That's correct. This is a provision which appears in the pre-printed form that's signed at the beginning and tells the world that renegotiation at some point in the future is a possibility. And I might add that I brought some copies of Stevens Nest trust deed and mortgage forms here. They don't include that language. Often, we're talking about not just institutional lenders here, but just individuals who aren't necessarily going to get a lawyer or certainly don't want to get a lawyer to do their transaction or making some sort of sale of their house or whatever. They're not going to be familiar with this provision of Oregon law. They'll use a Stevens Nest form. The borrower gets into trouble sometime later. And now they find that a workout arrangement, which is otherwise sensible, will cause them to go from being the holder of a first lien to the holder of a second lien. And the deal falls apart and it's impossible to close. The bill is designed to encourage workouts. The bar believes that it is not desirable to encourage foreclosures and to encourage lawsuits, and that anything which inhibits the ability of the parties to reach a deal which makes economic sense to both of them is undesirable. And we believe that a provision which prevents you from doing this unless you've had the legal advice to put this in your documents at the beginning is not appropriate.
What about my question with respect to something here? What happens after you do this? I mean, is there disclosure to say that this is the consequences of us doing this? I mean, it's not going to be that you're paying 21% interest and we haven't told you about it for sure, or it's 21% interest beginning 3 years from now, and in the meantime, we're going to give it to you for 8% interest or something. I'm using very crazy examples, but I'm more concerned. I think this is fine. I want to make sure that once you recut the deal, that somebody knows from the consumer point of view what happened to them and what to expect, not just next month, but 2 years from now, next month, when some other kinds of provision may or may not kick in. So that's the piece that I need some explanation about, and then I'm going to, I know Senator Bunn has a question.
I understand. The agreement between the lender and the borrower is completely voluntary. The lender has no power to say, unless it's part of the original deal, we're going to bump the interest rate or whatever. So we're talking about the borrower and the lender getting together, sitting down in a room, and agreeing that a change in the interest rate is the solution or whatever. So from the point of view of the consumer knows because the consumer agreed to the deal. From the point of view of the rest of the world, which is what this bill really deals with, because it's a recording bill, it deals with what's of record in the mortgage records of the county. There is no provision to disclose to anybody else what happened. In other words, if the first lien holder and the borrower get together and agree that the interest rate will be reduced from 12% to 10%, and I should emphasize, by the way, that's the usual way these things work. You got a borrower can't pay at 12, you can be pretty sure they're not going to be able to pay at 15, and you're not doing anybody any good by increasing the rate. It's usually a reduction. In any event, they reach an agreement to reduce the interest rate. There is no provision to tell anybody else other than the borrower and the lender that that has been done.
But the borrower knows.
The borrower knows.
Madam Chair, well, right now with the status quo, obviously the bill can be good for the borrower and is definitely good for the first mortgage holder. But dealing with the second mortgage holder, now if I hold the second mortgage, I'm guaranteed that if this disclaimer isn't included, I know the conditions of that mortgage that's got to be satisfied first, and then my mortgage is dealt with. But under this provision, if we adopt this, as far as the rest of the world or the second mortgage holder, if I have a second mortgage, I have no control at that point, do I? Because you could then actually change the balance due under the first mortgage, and even though I filed my second mortgage, I'm helpless to deal with that. I made a second mortgage contingent upon understanding the first, but you're telling me the interest rate, the terms, the length, all of those can be changed on the first mortgage, and I'm now subject to that.
That's correct, and I should specify, and I have been discussing this matter with representatives of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, and I want to make sure the committee knows. This bar bill was proposed last summer. It was publicized. It was circulated. We assumed that all interested parties were aware of what was going on. This morning, the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association raised exactly the point you raised right there. And I am, and the Oregon Bar will be dealing with that group. We've got some ideas about some things which can be done to protect everybody, and we may be able to reach a solution. That said, I do have a couple of specific responses to your point. The first is that I think that most people who haven't read the entire Oregon Revised Statutes and aren't familiar with the presence of this bill assume that that kind of renegotiation is a possibility. And if they take a second mortgage, they assume